Hey, llama llama, red pajama, reads a story with who? With his mama, hey.
Llamas seem to be having a moment, and not just in the hip-hop world. The Douglas County Fair was last week, and it had the usual county fair fare. You know, 4-H kids showing their livestock like cattle and goats to the judges. But this year, llamas were the big draw. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're going to talk llamas, starting at the Douglas County Fairgrounds. Our intern, Riley Kester, takes us there.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started with our showmanship class.
About 50 people are in the stands getting ready for the big llama competition. Abby Brown is in the wings. She's 12 years old, the same age as her llama.
He is white with black, brown, gray spots on him, and very small, tiny little llama.
His name is Dolly, as in the Dalai Lama, which seems to be a popular name for llamas. Abby has been competing in the llama show with Dolly since she was 7. They live on a farm in Linwood, Kansas, where Dolly helps protect the other animals. Abby says she was pretty excited when she first got Dolly.
I ran up to my mom. I'm like, I'm showing a llama. And she's like, what? I'm like, yep, I'm showing a llama. And I told everyone, even over and over. I was just so excited.
Abby gets up early the morning of the competition. When she first gets to the fairgrounds, she tends to her llama. She gives him food and water and brushes him so he's ready for the competition.
And then after that, we leave him alone till 8:30, which is the showtime. And then we get their halter on and walk him up there.
Abby says she's been showing Dolly for so long, she doesn't really think about what awaits her in the show pen. She's more concerned with Dolly. Abby says just before the competition, Dolly's ears went back and he started to cry before entering the ring because he was a little nervous. So she pet him and told him he's okay.
Next in the ring, we have Abby Brown.
The 4-H'ers compete in 5 classes that display their relationship with their llama and the training they've done. One of those classes involves an obstacle course with cones to weave through, a teeter-totter to cross, and they even have the llamas walk backwards.
I get asked every year by all of them, how do you back him up so good? I'm like, I just take the lead and kind of put my hands on the side and push him back so that he knows he needs to go straight back, not to side to side. And that helps him a lot.
There's another class that's pretty unique to the Douglas County Llama Project. It's one that draws a lot of attention.
Our next class is the costume class. And all of our exhibitors will get their llamas ready, but don't leave. This is the best part.
The exhibitors come up with elaborate costume designs for themselves and their llamas.
We got Mario Kart for the Nintendo, and I've been beating everyone at it. I'm the best at it. And I'm like, this year, we should do Mario Kart theme. And so me and my mom, we got cardboard boxes, we spray painted them red and green, and we got these little plates for tires.
The first time they tried it on Dolly, though, he destroyed it.
So when we got it back, we had to make some adjustments. He does not like his butt being touched, so we had to extend that end. And then we had to tape it a lot, like a lot, and he has some dents in it from it, but we made it work.
Abby says Dolly is calm and chill, which makes him pretty tolerant when it comes to wearing these elaborate costumes.
At home, it's totally different. He's like, don't touch me, don't put that on me. And then when we get here, it's like paradise for him. He's like, yay, I'm out here. And it's probably because of all the other llamas. They're like friends. It's just like, because they've been around each other for, like, all this time.
Last year, Abby and Dolly dressed as Napoleon Dynamite and Tina the Llama. Dolly dressed in a Vote for Pedro t-shirt, a curly wig, and big glasses. After that crowd-pleasing costume, guess who won the costume contest for the 2nd year in a row?
Congratulations to our champion costume exhibitor, Abby Brown from the Eudora 4-H Club.
So, what does Abby like most about competing with her llama Dolly?
The attention. Like, everyone's around you, and they're like, oh, can I get a picture of you and your llama in the costume? I'm like, yeah. It's just so fun.
That report from the Llama Show at the Douglas County Fair comes to us from KCUR intern Riley Kester. And now, more on the growing love for llamas with Mason Kelso. He's the interim superintendent of the Douglas County Llama Project. Hi, Mason.
Hi.
So I understand that the llama project, which is what the costume contest comes out of, that it just made its way into the 4-H program in Douglas County within the last 10 years?
That is correct. It's been a project that's existed in other echelons of 4-H throughout the state and the country. But in Douglas County specifically, it really hasn't shown up until the last decade.
Would you say that there has been growing demand for it? I ask this because, as I hinted earlier in the show, llamas are very popular right now. And I had noticed llamas on consumer goods like tote bags and sweaters. But then getting ready for the show, I found an article asserting that llamas are the new unicorns. And the author brought in concrete evidence like a huge increase in Etsy searches for llama decor and that kind of thing. Are llamas cool right now?
In my opinion, I think they are. Definitely as a consumer myself, whenever I'm out in retail stores, I see it a lot more now than necessarily when I was growing up 10 to 15 years ago. So I definitely think that for some reason, they are on the rise in popularity.
So what can you tell us about llamas that the typical listener would be unlikely to know, even if they recently attended a llama-themed birthday party?
So one of the things that a lot of people have a misconception about llamas is that they spit frequently. And llamas do have the capability of spitting. They spit bile and other secretions, and it's a natural defense mechanism for them. However, a domesticated llama will only spit at someone or another animal if they feel that their safety is threatened or their territory is threatened.
Yeah, this gets into that I have had limited contact with llamas in my life, but I have had contact with llamas, and that is as guard animals for more sort of like defenseless livestock on farms, like guard llamas.
Right. We, on my farm, my parents' farm in Kansas, we actually have a couple of llamas that we keep around as such guard animals. Particularly around this time of the year, it's very important because it's a heavy calving season. So we have a lot of newborn calves, and the mothers are very protective of their calves. But at the end of the day, a coyote is much faster than a one-ton heifer. And so the llamas help to protect the herd, and one of their defense mechanisms is the spitting. And if they aim it correctly, the spit can actually blind an animal. And the other defense mechanism they have as guard animals is their hooves. Because of how their hooves are shaped, it's almost like a very long fingernail that curves under slightly. And so it creates a very sharp toenail. And if the llama kicks a predator enough, it can kick it to death.
Whoa. So yeah, you don't want to get on a llama's bad side.
No, you really don't. They are very docile animals for the most part, but if you do end up on the unfortunate bad end of a llama, it's not necessarily pretty.
So what else do you think the typical llama-like fanatic, if you could call it that, from a consumer goods standpoint, just like the image of a llama on a tote bag or whatever, like, what else does that person maybe not know about llamas and should?
I think one thing that they may not know is llamas are highly intelligent creatures. You know, just from being on the internet and on different social media apps, I get the feeling that people treat llamas kind of like this thing, and it's not really a smart creature. But llamas, in my experience in raising them and caring for them, they're highly intelligent creatures, which is a good and a bad thing. It's good because they are highly trainable, such as the courses that we have to do in the shows require a high level intelligence. But the bad side to that is they're very smart about getting out of their pens and getting out of enclosures. For instance, one of the llamas I trained throughout the years was very good at undoing knots when you would tie them up with their lead ropes. So I had to learn how to tie a very different knot when I was tying that llama up so she would not undo her lead rope.
So, like, a llama is a pretty good, like, match for the human intellect in some ways, like, especially when it comes to knots.
Oh, yeah.
Where on earth did the idea for a costume contest come from?
I'm not sure where the class idea originated from. I know it is a part of several shows throughout the state. We're not the only ones that do the costume class. But the main aim of the costume class is to show the bond that the trainer has with the animal. And with the costume class, we really like to see animals have something draped around their legs or something on their heads, because llamas are very sensitive in those two areas, and they really naturally do not like stuff on their heads and don't like stuff dangling around their feet.
And so if someone can do it, that means the animal trusts them.
Right, that's the main goal. Like at the costume show this year, we had several llamas wearing hats, a couple of them wearing things that would dangle down to the ground, and it shows that there is a strong bond between the owner and the llama.
So I'm assuming that is part of how you judge the costume contest. What other criteria come into it?
So the costume class judging is a little subjective because the one element is those elements of, can the llama wear something on the head? Can the llama wear something around the feet? But the other element, too, is the costume class is really a chance for the 4-H'ers to be super creative and push the boundaries about what they can do. And so that creativity and the training are really the two main facets of what the costume class is judged on. And creating a costume that if somebody were to walk down off the street, they could immediately point and say, oh, that's Mario Kart, or that's Rocky Balboa, or that's a llama at a hula event.
Okay. Well, so we first got interested in the llama show as a result of some very compelling tweets about the llamas. And the author of those tweets is here with us, too. Amber Fraley is a freelance writer from Lawrence Magazine. Hi, Amber.
Hi.
So you have actually covered this event for 2 years, and I get the feeling you are genuinely inspired by it.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't really understand what I was getting into, but I just love it.
In Lawrence, I'm guessing that some of your readers do have farm connections, but probably a lot also don't. That's part of the whole, like, Douglas County-Lawrence relationship, is that it both is connected to the agricultural part of the state, but it is also, Lawrence is very much a college town and has people from everywhere, from every kind of background. How do you connect over something like a llama show at the county fair?
I mean, I think that the project makes it easy because they just do a really great job of connecting the public with the llamas. They make it easy for me. The kids make it easy for me.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, as you said, llamas right now are kind of having a moment. And so this is an opportunity to show the public the cute side of llamas. And they are very cute and they're very smart. But also, I try to also tweet out facts about llamas. And the Kelso family, Mason and his whole family, are such llama experts. They have given me lots of information over the years about llamas, and it's just a great opportunity, I think, to connect the cultural fun of llamas with the very practical farm side of them as well.
Part of what you chronicle is like what these kids can get their llamas to do. And one of the activities, you show one young person trying to get his llama, Rocky, to step in a pan of water.
Right.
Yes, that's one of the events we have in our PAC class. And part of that class is aimed to show what llamas naturally were first domesticated for. Llamas were first domesticated in the Andes regions of South America. And because they're more dexterous than animals such as oxen or horses, they were often used for the rocky terrains of the Andes Mountains as pack animals. Now, the llamas that grow up on the farms around here don't necessarily have those terrains because we're mainly a prairie state. But putting the feet in the water pan shows that the llama, if needed, could do what they were first domesticated to do.
Huh. Amber, so you tweet a picture of a llama, a white llama dressed as an Oreo with two dark cookies on either side of him. And he's standing next to a human, this is a she. She is standing next to her human, a kid dressed up as milk. So they've gone together as milk and cookies. And you write about this, y'all, the costume game is strong this year. What did you love about that costume? And I wonder if there are just other costumes you want to tell us about.
Well, I just love Colin and Dolly. That's Colin and Dolly. Dolly, D-O-L-L-Y. All the kids have great relationships with their llamas, but Dolly and Colin are just so close. She stands next to him. If he's anywhere in the area, she is right next to him. The first time I met them, when I walked up to Colin and Dolly, she marched right up to me, sniffed me all over to make sure that I was acceptable to be in the area, I think, with her human. And when she decided I was okay, she stepped back next to Colin.
So, Mason, I have to admit something to you. I do enjoy llamas. I get very excited when I see them. But I think that is partly because there's something like awkward and strange about their appearance. And I don't mean any offense mm-hmm. to someone who has like llamas, but they walk really funny. Like they're kind of knob-kneed and they jerk their bodies around and they make crazy faces, which you definitely notice because unlike maybe a horse, they look you right in the eye.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So thoughts about the weirdness of llamas?
I think it's because like a lot of the llama tropes that are brought up in pop culture particularly and consumer materials, it doesn't necessarily accurately display what a llama does. A lot of them are drawn as animations and they don't necessarily look like a llama or behave like an actual llama does. And so I think because llamas are so prevalent in pop culture right now, a lot of people associate what pop culture says about a llama rather than what llamas actually are as physical creatures.
And so this costume contest would be an opportunity to sort of debunk some of that, because like a llama could be Napoleon Dynamite.
Right.
Well, any parting words, any final thoughts that our listeners, particularly city folks, that you hope people will take with them from this conversation?
Just that llamas are great animals, and I think it's very important that people educate themselves about the animals, because particularly there are those who are associated with certain associations that I won't name at this time that think that what we do with the llamas in the show can be miscommunicated as animal cruelty. And I just want it to be put out there that what we do with the llamas in the show is in no way a version of animal cruelty. It is a showcase of the emotional and physical bond between the llama and the owner. And just that people continue to educate themselves that we are lovers of llamas.
Mason Kelso, Amber Fraley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a look at a llama show that's gotten really popular in recent years at the Douglas County Fair. The fair just ended over the weekend. And we do know that many of our listeners are really needing to talk about the shooting in the Crossroads over the weekend. We will be doing that in just a little while. You can go ahead and call in if you want at 816-235-2888. When we return from the break, we will be turning our attention to a chef who's been traveling the country by Amtrak. I'm I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Chef Madison Butler, Chef Maddie for short, is based in Austin, but she spent her summer riding the rails, trying food all over the country, which sounds pretty much like the coolest way to spend a summer ever. She's in Kansas City right now, and we're excited to welcome her to the studio. Hi, Chef Maddie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So tell us about your trip. It's a paid internship, right?
Yeah, so I receive a small stipend. I work for the Rail Passengers Association. It is a nonprofit that does train and rail-based advocacy. We advocate for all different kinds of public transportation and multimodal accessibility.
Multimodal accessibility.
Mm-hmm. So trains, buses, ferries, scooters, rideshares, all of the ways that we use public transportation to connect our cities.
So riding the passenger rail on Amtrak is not, by most people, considered like a luxury form of travel. Mm-hmm. In this day and age. Can you talk to me about what it is actually like?
Yeah, so the service does vary across the country. You're going to see a faster service in the Northeastern Corridor with a more successful on-time performance. And as you transition to long-distance routes through the South, the Midwest, and over to the Pacific Northwest, this is where our advocacy really takes hold. So for those of you who aren't familiar, Amtrak will piggyback on other train networks. So there's like CN, BSTN, there's large companies, freight companies that own the rails. So what we do in many parts is to advocate for making sure that passenger rail does receive the priority that it's legally guaranteed. So since 1971, the Amtrak initiative has pushed to make passenger rail more accessible and call for passenger rail to be provided by these freight companies.
I am a big fan of train travel. I actually went to California on Amtrak as a 7-year-old.
Yeah.
It's not really the ideal age for that, I'll acknowledge. But I've gone to St. Louis that way a couple of times. It's got its charms, I will say. And this part, though, seems pertinent to a chef. The food situation on board.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah. So I've spoken at length with the food and beverage team at Amtrak. It's on my YouTube channel, at Rail Passengers, but there's a really cool video of going to the research and development kitchen and just checking out what they're working on. So I think it's a complicated issue. There's a lot of moving parts because, you know, some of these commissary kitchens are 600 miles or more away from each other. So you have a moving vehicle with limited internet access, which does prevent how you're able to run your data and analytics for, you know, stocking the train, making sure the commissary is full.
Are our standards just higher? Because, like, in the history of train travel and the history of food in the United States, there was food on trains, like, I think before most people even had telephones. So the idea that it's like really hard when you don't have the internet seems surprising to me.
Yeah. So, and it is, it's, we always say there's a lot of moving parts. It's kind of like a running joke. But so there's definitely a difference between the old timey private dining car services and what you're going to be able to get on public rail. And that's part of the reason I wanted to take this trip, too, is to highlight. So when you get off the train, there's so many great foodie destinations. And so I will sometimes, like, stop and pick things up before I get on board. A lot of the union stations, too, have good food. So I think there's ways to kind of maneuver around it. But definitely on long-distance trips, we need to make sure that people have access to, like, healthy, fresh food. And I've tasted through the contemporary menu that Amtrak's going to launch later. I'm not allowed to talk about most of it. It's tippy top secret. But the things that are on the horizon are going to help a lot with combating travel fatigue. It's going to give healthier options.
So the stops are like the main chef-oriented parts of your trip.
Yes. So, you know, we're going to a whole bunch of different foodie cities. It's 21 destinations over the course of 50 days. And I mean, so far I've been so fortunate. I've met great chefs. I've gotten to work in some kitchens with some really talented teams. And so I think food makes it easier to have some of those more difficult conversations. You know, it's kind of, nobody's really that mad when you're like eating dinner and having a civil discourse. And food is just one of those things that unites people and brings people together. And I think it's a good, you know, metaphor for how the train unites and brings people together.
So talk to me about the places you've been and the food you've eaten, because I am interested in what America is like through this kind of experience. Like, what have you tried that you might not have gotten to try if you had stayed in Austin?
Yeah, so I started off in Portland, Maine. I ate my weight in oysters, honestly. The lobster, clams, like there's so much great seafood and shellfish up there that I just don't have access to. You know, I grew up in Kentucky, moved to Texas, so not really known for its fresh lobsters.
No.
So that was really cool. And then down in Providence, I had amazing pasta at Trattoria Zuma. They did a squid ink pasta, Fra Diavolo, and so just loaded with all these really intense flavors. The two guys who run that restaurant are really creative. They use a lot of traditional methods in their traditional Italian food, but present it in ways that are really like modern and very sleek. So I liked that a lot. And then I got to say my favorite, though, is definitely Mertz Heart and Soul in Charlotte. Charlotte's a complicated city, and they have a lot of issues with their light rail and their bus that they need to improve. And so I've definitely put a little pin in Charlotte to continue my advocacy there. But going to a Soul restaurant that was just, I mean, they've been there for 20 years, and fried chicken, salmon cakes, greens, mac and cheese, like all these home foods that I really love. So that's probably my favorite.
How did you become a chef / transportation advocate?
That's a fun question. let me see if I can sum up my whole life story for time.
Yeah, do it.
So I spent a lot of time doing community work, volunteer work, and advocacy when I lived in Kentucky. You know, it was a big part of the Kentucky Workers League, and we pushed to create safe housing, safe access, transportation, combat food deserts, which are a really common problem in Kentucky. And then that kind of brought me into rural accessibility, which I think as far as my involvement with the Rail Passengers Association is like, that's my linchpin. That's my key, you know? So we have 1200 counties in the United States with no access to public transportation. 45% of the population lives rurally. Yet we see almost 21% of the population engage in some form of public transportation over the course of an annual year. So I think that's really what brought me around to it. And seeing staff as I opened different restaurants, worked in hotels that relied on public transportation. And sometimes the people that are working till 2-3 o'clock in the morning, or your bakers that go in first thing, don't have access to bus or light rail.
I would think, especially, you know, when you're talking about rural areas, the less dense a community is, the more challenging public transit becomes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I think it's why it's so crucial to support things like environmental impact studies and population surveys to see sort of what the engagement is like. And I think for communities that rely on jobs like production, where there is sort of a center where people could be dropped or used as a hub for transportation, the environmental impact studies definitely help with that.
So when you took on this trip, you were mm-hmm. thinking about trying the food. You were also thinking about doing shows like this, talking about yeah. public transit. Why is Kansas City, first of all, a good food destination? But I guess before we get mm-hmm. to the food piece, maybe why is Kansas City an interesting place to come and do transit advocacy?
Yeah. Well, there's the streetcar, and they're looking at expanding the streetcar service out to the plaza. I think the Kansas City streetcar is really cool. The bus service here is definitely on the up and up. And, you know, I see a lot of students that are coming through the area, a lot of young people that are kind of returning to Kansas City. So the reinvestment in the community here, I mean, of course, there's the historic barbecue scene. Any recommendations, please send them my way.
Oh, boy, you just opened the floodgates there.
Yeah.
Well, so, but Kansas City's transit issues, I am curious mm-hmm. from the perspective of someone who's been traveling around, yeah. talking about this stuff, looking at it, and is passionate about it. How do you think it fits into the national picture?
I think maintaining affordability is really crucial because, like, the bus here is fairly affordable.
And there's talk about making it free.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, that is the best for everyone. That creates universal accessibility as long as route maintenance and free service are tied together.
Have you seen examples of cities where that's been the case?
Yeah, I was just in Milwaukee, actually. I'd never been to Wisconsin. I'd never been to Milwaukee, but they have the Hop, which is a free light rail service that goes up and down Main Street. And they're looking at expanding to cover both like the brewery and the travel side of their city. So I think it's a really cool initiative.
Okay, so we've explored Kansas City as a transit advocacy destination, but you are a chef. Mm-hmm. What about Kansas City as a food destination? What were your expectations as you made that call? Like, I'm going to put Kansas City on this itinerary.
Well, I love barbecue. I mean, I live in Austin, Texas, so barbecue is king, right? And I wanted to see some of the newer restaurants. And this afternoon, I'm actually going to really get a chance to, like, walk around through downtown. So far, I've only really explored the plaza. But, like, I went to Prime Sushi yesterday, and I was just not expecting, like, a really good bento box in Kansas City. And, you know, I think going through this trip, too, not just for myself, but for the viewers and the people joining me along on the adventure, breaking down some of those unconscious biases about, like, what a place is or isn't. And I think just giving a first-person narrative and first-person perspective on that helps to really do that.
Is there a place where you do feel like you found something that broke down a narrative that is best broken down?
Yeah. You know, I would say Meridian, Mississippi, and Greenwood, Mississippi. I have my grandparents are from Mississippi. I have family that's buried out there. So it's an area that I've, like, spent time in, but not extensively, and not as a transportation advocate or as a chef. So getting to see, especially in Meridian, they have the MAX, which is the Mississippi Arts and Entertainment Experience. And it's this really cool combination of, like, a gallery, museum, venue, Hall of Fame, recording studio. And it's just not something you expect when you hop off, like, a sleepy little town in Mississippi. But the Delta is such a wealth of creativity and art, and it's, you know, of historic importance. So it's really cool to see that kind of just manifest out of, well, to me it felt like nowhere, but I know a lot of people put hard work into it.
So thinking about Kansas City as a place where a narrative might break down, I mean, you talked about finding good seafood here, but also when you talk about pursuing barbecue, that is sort of like, if there's sort of a free association, like you list names of cities and say the one thing you think of, it's like Kansas City barbecue. And I'm curious what else interests you about our culinary scene?
Well, I'll have more on that after I go and explore downtown. There's also something...
You're doing the exploring first, and you'll have that answer later.
Yeah. There's something I want to check out. It was called the Green Lady Lounge. That looked really cool. I saw it on Instagram, and there's also, like, a pretty good jazz scene here. So I think tonight I might, let my hair down and get people to explore it.
So I know that you are on the train to get to the food destinations mm-hmm. that intrigue you and to do this transit advocacy, but I am wondering what you have learned about America, what you've observed that maybe has nothing to do with food or transit.
Sorry, I'm like a very nostalgic and emotional person. So yeah. I think that just like enhancing our connectivity and like breaking down biases, breaking down stereotypes. And, you know, I mean, we all need methods to connect to one another. And so I think on this trip, you know, I'm meeting all different kinds of people from all different walks of life. And it's such a tumultuous time right now. And I feel like a lot of people are really, they're hurting and they feel isolated and alienated. And so much of this trip is about connectivity and attachment and enhancing and investing and developing the country that we reside in.
And you feel like you've had the opportunity to do that?
I think I've witnessed a lot of great people who are actively doing the work to make those kind of things happen.
Can you give me an example of someone to leave us on a note of hope?
Absolutely. I can give you multiple people.
Yeah.
So Wayne Davis and Patricia Quinn up in Maine, they started the first passenger initiative to reinstate rail service. Is the first citizens initiative that was federally funded. So that's done great things for Maine. Chef James down in Charlotte, you know, I mean, he's a strong black male chef who's really just crushing it. And he's setting a new standard for what Charlotte can become, you know, and up in Milwaukee, like with the Hop, these people that are really invested. There's great transit riders and activists all through Chicago up to Milwaukee. And just seeing people that really just care. You know, it's in my blog, summerbyrail.com, @railpassengers on Instagram. But yeah.
Chef Maddie, Madison Butler, with us courtesy of Amtrak. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having me.
Madison's been traveling the country by train to try the local cuisine. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now it's time to turn our attention to the gun violence at First Fridays. How are you and your communities responding to what happened over the weekend, especially in the context of nationwide headlines about mass shootings? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Let's talk about it. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, a shooting at First Fridays this past weekend took the life of a Kansas City woman who worked as a therapist for the Rose Brooks Center. It is tragic and senseless, and our hearts go out to anyone who knew her. Deadly gun violence is unfortunately not new or even unusual in Kansas City. But the incident is a first for First Fridays, and it may be shaking people's sense of safety in big crowds and at big events throughout the metro. Has it changed anything for you? Will it change anything for you? How are you and your friends reacting to what's just happened? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. You can also tweet us. We are at KCUR CST. I'm joined in the studio by KCUR's Andrea Tudhope, who did a big reporting project on gun violence in our metro last year. And she continues to tell the stories of people affected by gun violence as she covers the daily news. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Gina.
As Mayor Quentin Lucas pointed out in his remarks, and as you've been acknowledging on Twitter, there was more than one fatal shooting in Kansas City this past week.
Yeah, so I think it's more than fair to say we don't see the level of shock and outrage that we saw this weekend after the fatal shooting in the Crossroads, as we do to other incidents across our city. We had four homicides 4 days in a row, starting last Wednesday. It was 23-year-old Aaron Mason, who was shot and killed outside of Wendy's at 31st and Main. Then on Thursday, 62-year-old Michael Pittman was found dead at 32nd in Indiana. Of course, then Friday night in the Crossroads, Aaron Langhofer, who was 25, was fatally shot. And then the very next night, Saturday night, 26-year-old John Knoll was shot and killed near 55th and Prospect. So there was an outpouring on social media in response to Aaron's killing. The prosecutors, police, and mayor held a press conference. People were mad, and they should be mad. We should all be mad when these things happen. But, you know, I think it's important to pay attention to how we talk about these incidents and which incidents we pay attention to. I actually saw a member of local media post on Twitter this weekend, "This could have been any of us," about the Crossroads incident. And I think we need to work on being alarmed whether it could have been any of us or not. And I think that language really impacts how we perceive violence.
Yeah, can you unpack that a little bit? I mean, the idea that maybe a lot of people in a position to be like having the public discourse don't see themselves in every victim.
Yeah, well, and this is something I've thought about before and talked about before. Our incidents of violence are concentrated in certain areas, and we have a tendency to think, if we don't live in those areas, if these are not our friends or our neighbors, that it's separate from us. But I think we all need to start thinking a little more collectively about what's happening. And I think that really also does come from the media and people in positions of power, which is why, I mean, I was appreciative of Mayor Quentin Lucas's remarks and acknowledging the other incidents leading up to this incident, even.
Yeah, so. And he will be on Up to Date, the show that follows this one. You know, I'm curious, for someone who has one foot as a reporter in a world where gun violence is by no means normal. It's not normal anywhere, but definitely not uncommon. And then another foot in the arts world, in places where something like this is incredibly unusual. How have you been navigating the different kinds of reactions?
Yeah, well, those reactions have not been surprising to me. A shooting in a crowd where thousands of people are gathered is different than a shooting in a house or an empty neighborhood at night. There's a greater likelihood that more people will get hurt when a shooting happens in a crowded place. You know, I think I've said this a bit, but I think we need to work harder to care just as much when someone is killed in a place where this kind of violence doesn't happen as when as in places where it does happen often. And from my reporting, I know, like I said earlier, that this violence is concentrated in certain areas. And I've interviewed especially young people about how they feel about this. And they will say that it feels normal to hear gunshots, to find out someone has been killed. It should not be normal, as you said. And, you know, I think that it needs to not be normal anywhere. And I just kept thinking this weekend, if we saw the same level of outrage every time a violent incident, a homicide happened, I just kept wondering, like, how our city would be different, honestly.
Do you think that it could be one of those things that increases people's sensitivity to that?
That what could?
Just being a little closer to something.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think a lot more people are talking about homicides and gun violence after what happened Friday night than were before, or at least thinking about it.
I want to talk to Paul. Paul is contacting us from Independence. Hi, Paul.
Okay, first off, it's Carl.
Okay.
Not that it matters.
Go on.
The underlying problem is, you know, we're going to hear a lot of talk about gun control. That's not the problem. These are inanimate objects, and they're run by violent people. I've just read across a book by Thomas Abbott. He's a Harvard professor, senior research fellow at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. The book is Bleeding Out, and I cannot recommend it high enough. What he is saying, basically, in a nutshell, is that we have been nipping at this violence problem at the peripheral. We've been calling it guns, gangs, and drugs. And that's not the problem. He says we need to directly go after the violent people.
Okay.
And we're talking 3%, and we can isolate them. And we have to deal with them in three different classes of people. The active shooters, these people need to go. The wannabes, the up-and-coming, and then the potential future shooters.
All right, Paul, I feel like we may be getting a bit off track in looking for sort of criminal justice expertise, and that's not quite the show we're having at this moment, but it's a very important topic, and I appreciate your raising that issue. I want to talk now with Spencer, who is calling from Kansas City. Hi, Spencer.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Hey, my question was, it seemed like in 2017 we had a real problem in Westport with shootings and violence and gun crime in particular that made people really feel less safe going out there. And even though it was kind of unpopular, the city took some steps to implement additional security measures. And it seems like, and at least in my experience, I feel a lot safer returning there. There have been a lot less shootings. So I guess my question is, how do you guys feel about the responsibility of the city to expand additional security measures like metal detectors and, you know, things other than just increased law enforcement presence?
Before I get Andrea has done some reporting on this stuff going on in Westport, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I am curious whether this singular incident in the Crossroads has made you crave something like that in other neighborhoods, in perhaps the Crossroads on First Fridays.
I think that the way that we did it in Westport was good. It's made me feel afraid, and like I want the city to provide a solution, and I don't like feeling afraid in my own neighborhood.
All right, thank you, Spencer. Let's get some insights from Andrea.
I think they did a good job in Westport of making it so it wasn't like we just installed security all the time, but rather we focused on, you know, if there's going to be a large
high traffic.
Of people. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Andrea, what do you think your reporting on Westport and how that's been handled might tell you about something like this?
Yeah, well, similarly, like I was saying earlier, when incidents of violence happen in crowded places, there's more likelihood that more people will get hurt, and there's fear around that. The Westport privatization measures were controversial, but, you know, I have heard from some people they feel safer. I've also heard from some people they feel like they're not welcome in Westport. And I don't know what the city will do in response to what happened in the Crossroads. But, you know, I think we will be hearing a lot about what makes people feel safe and where they feel safe and why. So
let's talk to Alex in Kansas City. Alex has called us at 816-235-2888. And the question we're asking today is whether the shooting in the Crossroads this weekend has changed anything for you, either in your perception of violence or perhaps your comfort going to big citywide events. 816-235-2888. There's just a little time left to join the conversation. Alex in Kansas City, good morning.
Good morning, Tina. So I'm looking at it from a different angle, and while I think it's equally tragic, we cannot afford to argue the obvious in terms of the news coverage among people of color in homicides of a white young lady from Leawood. They are all equally tragic, and at the same time, all of their families and friends are dealing with these losses all the same. So the fact that this young lady's homicide got news coverage and is getting attention, you know, at a higher level than people of color, we can't claim that all lives matter the same when they are not being treated the same. Even just the way that white domestic terrorists are treated when they are apprehended, you know, we noticed even just over the weekend with the El Paso shooter, who was just gently handcuffed, whereas here at home, a couple of weeks ago, we had the KC Police Department and ICE drag a man out of his vehicle in front of his children and his partners. So we cannot ignore that.
So this is sort of, Andrea, what you were sort of alluding to.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that call. I think it's really, really important to point out, and I think we need to be thinking about how we talk about these incidents. And that's why I took to Twitter this weekend to say, like, you know, no matter who it is, no matter where it is, whether it could, quote, could have been any of us or not, we need to be paying attention. We need to be telling these people's stories and paying attention every time someone is killed.
Let's talk to Michael in the West Plaza. Hi, Michael.
How you guys doing?
All right. How about you?
I'm doing okay. I have kind of a unique perspective in regards to gun violence in Kansas City. At the age of 14, I was actually shot by another kid on accident with a gun that he had actually for protection from other situations going on in the neighborhood, and have worked to try to quell that type of situation all of my life. I was actually at the crossroads in that incident, participating in a hip-hop event over by the Birdie's shop, and saw that whole situation go down. I've also been in other areas that were perceived to be far more dangerous than that on First Fridays, and everything was absolutely calm with no police presence whatsoever. So I'm trying to figure out exactly how we can portray or convey the fact that it's the guns and not necessarily the people, and not to say strip all of the guns, but the proliferation of them is kind of what's fostering this environment of shoot first, ask questions later.
You know, Michael, what interests me about your call is this observation that you have also been in places that are perceived as unsafe and ultimately been much safer in those places.
Quite honestly, and I'll probably get in trouble for this in my own personal life, but being in First Friday events recently where several individuals were heavily armed and inebriated, and it was still the most peaceful situation, I felt more comfortable there than I did at the crossroads area prior to, just because of the, I guess, not the police presence, but I talk to the police. I have various conversations with the police. Some police will converse with me and talk with me. Some will not. And that's one of those things. And I don't want to pull the race card or even address which police that I speak to and which I don't. I have family members that are in law enforcement, that type of thing as well. So I get a chance to actually talk to these individuals. And the police presence in Kansas City, it's kind of fractured at this point, at least as far as I can see.
Well, Michael, thanks for that call. I want to turn to one last caller very quickly, Julia in the Crossroads. We've got just a little more time, but I thought I'd hear your take.
Hi. I live here, obviously, and First Fridays is an amazing event. It's not always my cup of tea, but how great it's happening in our city. And the thing that's really distressing to me is the first thing that so many people want to do is put more restrictions on public freedoms, when the thing that makes me really scared is that people are walking around with guns in public. And so I wish we could think more about how do we balance individual freedoms with public freedoms? How do we not throw out things that we really care about in order to supposedly make us feel less afraid?
Well, Julia, thanks for that call. Andrea, any other observations about the way people are talking about this and the direction you expect the conversation to go?
Well, when this topic comes up, our gun laws in Missouri always come up, and I think that's what we heard from our last few callers. But, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see how the conversations change moving forward. Like I said, I think more people are talking about gun violence, at least this weekend, than were before this weekend. So we'll see what happens.
Thanks to everyone who called in to the show this morning to talk about the fatal shooting in the Crossroads this weekend. It's a lot to process. We'll continue talking about all the issues that converge on this story as a show going forward. And again, our hearts go out to Erin Langhofer and everyone who knew her. We are also saddened by the deaths of Aaron Mason, Michael Pittman, and John Noel. Deepest condolences to their families and friends as they cope and grieve. Andrea Todd Hope, thanks for anchoring this conversation.
Thanks, Gina.
Andrea is the general assignment reporter here at KCUR, and she covers communities affected by trauma and violence regularly here for the station. That's a wrap. Tomorrow we will be back with a show on an unusual billboard in Kansas City. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with intern Riley Kester and Ann Kniggendorf. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.